You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire. 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Harry Willis tōku noa, nō mai, haere mai, ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to The Wire for today. It's Thursday the 21st of March. My name is Harry Willis and I'll be your host today. I'm filling in for Stuart because he is away. We're joined in studio today by fantastic producers Olivia Holdsworth and Grace Watson. Hi guys, how are we going?
Yeah, not bad.
Good.
Have we had a good morning so far?
It's been a good morning. It's been sunny.
Yes.
And I've had coffee, so I'm really good.
Yeah, we're prepared for the show. FIAKNA coming up on the show today. Olivia will be chatting with the University of Otago Professor of Peace Studies, Kevin Clements, on gun control laws and history. Grace will be speaking with Sean Robinson, the Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation, after their announcement that extremism cannot be categorised as a mental illness. I will be speaking with 95BFM European correspondent Justin Wong. He's in Paris. We'll be talking about Brexit developments. And then I'll be speaking with artist Erez Katki on the Persian New Year Nowruz and on minority treatment and racism in New Zealand. Finally, today we'll be hearing from Ikhlaq Kashkari, the President of the New Zealand Muslim Association, on the reopening of four Auckland mosques tomorrow evening. Remember that you can catch all of these stories and more by podcast on the 95BFM website after the show. If you want to share your thoughts with us, tuku pātui mai, you can text us on 5395 Waia Mai Rane or give us a call in studio on 309 3879. All right, let's get started.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Waia.
In the wake of the Christchurch terror attack, New Zealand is looking to make rapid changes to its gun laws. Today I took a look at how laws are currently standing and how gun laws are only one aspect to preventing an atrocity like this occurring again. I spoke to Professor of Peace and Conflict Studies at the University of Otago, Kevin Clement, and began by asking about historical pushes for gun law reform and why these suggestions were never ratified.
I wish that's a $64 question. If all of the recommendations of the Thorpe Court of 1997 had been implemented, then the gunman wouldn't have been able to buy the weapons he bought to commit this massacre in Christchurch. So from 1997 to now, I mean, we've had some very, very positive suggestions on the table, and they've been resisted because the government has been susceptible to gun lobby recommendations and a desire not to place too many controls over New Zealand weapons.
Can you tell me a bit more about the Thorpe Report from 1997?
Yes, the Thorpe Report was probably New Zealand's most comprehensive inquiry into gun law and gun control. And he made a whole variety of recommendations, including a complete ban on military-style semi-automatic weapons, a complete ban on pistols, registration of firearms to owners, and reporting a re-registration time period of 3 to 5 years instead of 10 years, so that when your gun license would lapse every 5 years instead of every 10 years, so that the police could keep reviewing the worthwhileness of the gun licensee.
I understand that the shooter obtained his weaponry through a loophole in the law. Apparently, you need an E-category license to purchase?
Yes, he had a Category A license, which does entitle you to buy an AR-15. If you want to buy an AR-15 with a magazine of 30 cartridges, you need to have a Category E license, which he didn't have. But this is the loophole in the law that the police have been trying to address for about the last 3 or 4 years. Because what happens is that you turn semi-automatic rifles with just 7 cartridges in the magazine into basically submachine guns with 30 cartridges, and you can do that just by buying the magazine. And that's the big gap in the law. Then you don't need to register them as an E-category license, which means that you have to register the firearm to the owner, and there are more restrictions on that license.
Obviously, in the wake of the attack, there's a massive focus on gun law reform. What changes do you see being made, or what's the process of changing gun laws?
Well, we're getting signs of this. I think there will be a desire to ban military-style semi-automatic weapons. It's going to be a little bit complicated because there'll have to be buyback provisions and so forth for people who've just bought them, but that's exactly what happened in Australia after the Port Arthur shootings, and then I think those weapons should then be destroyed, and then they won't be available for other people to purchase.
There's an argument that people will be committing violence regardless of laws preventing them if that's something that they want to do. What do you think about this?
Well, that's true. I mean, in America, in England right now, you have a large number of people being killed with knives. I mean, so knives and weapons are all available to people with murderous intent. The problem is that most of the homicides and so forth in New Zealand, most suicides are committed with some kind of weapon.
And also, just looking at the more bigger picture, it's not just gun laws which need to change to prevent this kind of violence occurring in the future, is it? It's more attitude.
I mean, I think, in peace research we always say we need to change people's attitudes, so we need a more tolerant, more inclusive, less prejudiced society. We've got to change behaviour so that people are called out if they're yobbos and are discriminating against people of minority groups. And we need to change our culture. We need to make sure that we're a culture that has, in which racism has no part, and hate speech and negative othering has no part as well.
And we assume that banning guns will kind of help stem.
Oh, banning guns is only one little piece of the puzzle. All of these other things need to be addressed simultaneously. I think it is true to say that, New Zealand has done pretty well on a lot of these issues, but, we do have deep pockets of racism, we do have deep pockets of intolerance. And unfortunately, since 9/11, we've not been open and sympathetic and compassionate towards Muslim citizens.
And there was also this issue of our intelligence services failing to monitor this extremist.
That's exactly right, because since 9/11, the attention's been focused on Muslims rather than on white extremists and others that might create mayhem. And I think that, because it's just assumed that, they're part of the majority and they wouldn't engage in such heinous acts. But now we know from this massacre, we know from the shootings in the Pittsburgh synagogue and from a whole variety of different incidents that, white racism is as violent in its consequences as radical Muslim extremism.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add regarding gun law reform or changing people's attitudes going forward?
Well, I think this is a wake-up call for all of us. I mean, it's a moment of terrible grief and sadness at this time. I think our Prime Minister is doing brilliantly. But it seems to me that, we need to kind of take positive action on guns, and we need to take positive action on all of the attitudes and behaviours that results in people who have access to guns using them to murder people.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
So, news coverage of the Christchurch terror attacks has openly debated the role of mental health in the gunman's actions. I spoke to Sean Robinson, Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation, about how extremism is not a mental illness. I began by asking him how he would describe the coverage of the Christchurch terror attacks.
I think it's been quite disturbing and very unhelpful, particularly in the last couple of days, because there's been one article in particular circulating that has linked mental health with violent crime and with violent attacks. But I think there has also been quite a lot of social media and discussion about the possibility of this terrorist having some kind of mental health problem. And I think that is really wrong for a whole range of reasons. For a start, it's all too convenient to portray this shooter as a lone wolf who had some individual problem, and therefore let us all off the hook for the fact that this is actually a terrorist act which has much more to do with extreme right-wing racist politics than it does with mental health issues. This person acted on the basis of their indoctrinated political beliefs around white supremacy, anti-Islamic politics and racism. Now that was made possible by the politics of anti-immigrant speak, anti-Muslim politics that is quite prominent in Australia, but also it emerges in New Zealand, both through politicians' positions, but also in media. This person, you know, was highly influenced by people writing, both online and in books, about political ideas, about white extremism. And, you know, that's really the issue. And the way that our society, Australian society, and many societies around the world allow racism to continue, and, you know, how from laughing at a racist joke or not opposing a racist comment, those little things all build to the situation where a sense that racism is acceptable can, that legitimizes more extreme views on race, and all leads towards this horrific attack that we've seen. So to convey the shooter as someone who had something individually wrong with them or was just an individual acting on their own really lets our whole society off the hook. It's also often the excuse that the gun lobby in America uses when they're trying to oppose gun control. They often try to portray mass shooters as people with mental health problems. In fact, the research and the facts show that this is completely untrue. In fact, the opposite is true. Research in America shows that people who have mental health problems are far less likely than the average person in the street to commit a crime of violence, a shooting crime, and certainly much less likely to be involved in a mass shooting. So, you know, it's completely wrong factually and completely wrong in terms of the way it frames this event. The other thing that I think is very wrong with it is the damage that it does to people who are living with mental health problems, such as myself. I live with bipolar disorder, and for some New Zealand media to be linking violent crime to mental health issues is extremely insulting and stigmatizing and damaging to all people who are genuinely working through their own mental health problems, because it implies that we are people to be feared, that inherently we're violent, prone to violence, and that somehow the mental health system needs to control us and protect us, protect the public from people with mental health problems. Again, that is, you know, completely factually untrue. People with mental health problems are in fact 14 times more likely to be the victims of violence than they are to be perpetrators of violence. And it just builds that whole stigmatizing, fear-based attitude to mental health that unfortunately still exists strongly in New Zealand. It makes people feel ashamed of their mental health problems. And we have to remember that half of all New Zealanders will have a serious mental health issue at some time in their life. And that stigma, that shame, that fear discourages people from wanting to be open about their own mental health issues and seeking help. So it is totally destructive from all those different angles to really link mental health to violence and to this shooting in particular.
Do you think that there is a similarity between the excuse people have been making of, oh, he was Australian, he wasn't a New Zealander, he wasn't one of us, and the excuse making of mental health?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there is always a desire for us to sort of push this away from us and make it feel like, you know, we are not part of this, we are not responsible. And of course, most Kiwis are not extreme white supremacists and terrorists. So that is a natural kind of inclination. I mean, this is abhorrent to modern Kiwi life. But again, we have to look more deeply at our collective responsibility for allowing this to happen. At a very straightforward level, the Muslim community have been warning and complaining about racist acts against them for years, which have not really been taken seriously. And by not responding to those effectively, well, you know, the situation has mounted to the point where we let this happen. So again, I think this desire for us to push this event away, while it is natural, you know, we have to also be, this is a time when we have to work hard to be the best New Zealand that we can possibly be. And part of that actually means being open to what can we change, what can we improve, how can we really push to end all forms of racism and discrimination in this country. So I think there is a similarity, looking for an excuse or a reason to limit the responsibility to this individual alone.
How do you think that we should move forward in talking about mental health and extremism?
Well, I think we shouldn't be leaking mental health and extremism. We should be talking about extremism as extremism. There was a similar case 2 years ago where in Britain a man killed an MP, and I was very disappointed that a lot of the British media and a lot of the media reported that this man had been in counselling for depression, as if that was a key cause, and spent very little time talking about the fact that he was part of a neo-Nazi group, that he subscribed to several fascist, white supremacist blogs. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to say that it was that extremism is what led to the extremist act. So I don't think we should be talking about extremism and mental health in the same sentence or the same conversation at all.
Now, we generally see the excuse of mental health only when the terrorists are white. What do you think about that?
Again, I think there's an inherent racism in that. We immediately leap to political and religious beliefs when we see other acts of terrorism, and we don't talk about mental health issues. So suddenly saying that a white person is driven by their mental health rather than their political views is a double standard, and actually is that's kind of really subtle racism, which is far harder to combat, but we need to surface that.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te waia, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
That was Sean Robinson, Chief Executive of the Mental Health Foundation, about how extremism is not a mental illness. We're just going to take a quick break right now, but we'll be back very shortly. For now, this is Saturday Night Stay at Home by the Suburban Reptiles.
Saturday night, take off the side of my room, my Saturday night, on Saturday night. Hey, boss.
Yeah,
no, good. Yeah, no, I just went to my doctor yesterday. She reckons I'm getting the flu soon, around Saturday, April 13th. Yeah, so I'm going to need that day off. Doctor's orders.
Clear your calendar. April 13 is Record Store Day, and you've got an appointment at Real Groovy Records.
Deals, exclusive releases, food, freebies, live music, and loads more.
Celebrate your local.
Record Store Day at Real Groovy, Saturday, April 13th, 520 Queen Street. Free parking.
Rise and shine, Auckland. It's 95 BFM Breakfast.
Morning, Auckland. Morning, New Zealand. Have you heard how good music can make you feel?
Mikey Havoc, Breakfast.
Should people want to wash their worries away in the ocean today? Is it a good day for a ride on the boards?
10 out of 10 today, Mikey.
Breakfast.
And on that positive note, hey, Troy.
Good day to you.
You brought the weather with you.
Thank you.
And a monthly chance to win a year's free broadband thanks to Orcon.
Is there anything that a naturopath would prescribe to generate more kindness, caring and empathetic thoughts and people?
Flower essences are good for that.
Holly.
Zinc's also good too.
95BFM Breakfast with Mikey Havoc.
Good on ya.
Every weekday, 7 to 10am.
The Wire.
We just had a couple of texts. Oh, sorry, welcome back to The Wire. We've just had a couple of texts of people just questioning what Sean Robinson was saying regarding mental health and whether or not symptoms of mental health driving people to make these, to do these crazy terrorist attacks. This person said, isn't hating other people based on their ethnicity a symptom of poor mental health? But Grace, you said that's beyond the point of what he was saying.
Yeah, so I think the point that Sean was making was that if you have poor mental health, you're more likely to be a victim of an attack than the perpetrator. So I think that's probably not listening to what he was saying at all. Like, there's no link between extremism or hating others and mental health.
All right. Okay, moving on with the show. I spoke with Justin Wong, who is our European correspondent. He is living in Paris. And so we just had a little chat earlier this morning regarding Brexit.
Give us a rundown of the week's events in terms of Brexit.
Earlier this week, British Prime Minister Theresa May has written a letter to the President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, requesting an extension to Article 50 until the 30th of June, which is 3 months. So what that means is Theresa May is trying to extend the official date of the UK leaving the European Union from the 29th of March until the 30th of June. However, the EU has kind of like rejected that a little bit, saying the best day for the extension is only until the 23rd of May. Hmm. But they can approve extending the deadline to the 30th of June under the condition that the House of Commons passes the withdrawal agreement. I'll later explain why the EU wants to delay the leave date only until the 23rd of May. Mm-hmm. But just only an hour ago, May made a TV statement saying it's high time for MPs to make a decision and said, quote, you want us to get on with it, and that is what I'm determined to do, end quote. But to sum that up, it's just blaming MPs for getting her into the mess she's currently right in.
Mm-hmm. The extension that she requested, I mean, a lot of people have said that it's like a finally moment. Was this a long time coming? Was she a bit in denial about actually requesting this extension for the deal?
Well, at this point, it's kind of like requesting an extension is inevitable, considering what happened, I think, last week, that Parliament, that the House of Commons actually passed a motion rejecting her second deal. Mm. And passing another motion ruling that the government can't leave a deal after all.
So is it likely that we're going to see a third motion for her deal?
And the current situation, not, because the Speaker of the House of Commons, John Bercow, has recently said during a sitting session in Westminster that the government can't put through the withdrawal agreement for a third, quote, meaningful vote, because for the past two attempts it had already been rejected by MPs by a very large majority.
Hmm.
So is that pretty much ruling out a third motion?
For now, it is. But if Theresa May made some improvements to the deal, some really big improvements to the deal that gave out a message that she had already, that she convinced most of the MPs to vote for the deal, I don't doubt that John Bercow would not allow a third meaningful vote to proceed.
And is that likely?
Well, considering it's highly unlikely, considering what May made in her TV statement an hour ago, because she's just pointing her finger to the MPs who voted against her deal, saying they are the ones responsible for putting the whole country into the situation that they are in right now.
So what does the next week ahead look like for May's deal?
So tomorrow Theresa May is going to Brussels to meet for a EU leaders summit alongside with President of the European Council, Donald Tusk, and 27 other European leaders. And no doubt Brexit will be on top of the agenda over there. But the EU has already said, I think this morning in Brussels, that they don't expect any progress made until in this week. But if anything happens in Downing Street or Westminster, like any progress, they will be able, and that satisfied them, they can officially call for an extra summit in Brussels next week.
All right, we'll move on. Just to touch briefly on Friday's terrorist attack in Christchurch. What has the response been like from European leaders?
So there has been a widespread condemnation of the attack all across Europe, such as French President Emmanuel Macron, who tweeted, and I translate, quote, all our thoughts for the victims of heinous crimes against the mosques of Christchurch in New Zealand and for their relatives. France stands against all forms of extremism and acts with its partners against terrorism in the world, end quote. And actually, yesterday, there has been a small vigil outside the New Zealand Embassy right here in Paris, and some deputies or MPs of the French National Assembly, as well as